So I went with a blackboard chalk, partly because my computer crashed 3 days ago, partly because I like blackboards. So I hope you'll be able to read what I write. If you don't, you can stop me. I can write bigger, smaller, just let me know.
I'm also not quite sure. I don't know many of you, so I'm not quite sure what my public is. So I'll try to go a little bit slow, maybe. But you know, if it's too slow, stop me. If it's too fast, ask questions, and then we can just adapt the rhythm. So I already changed the title compared to what Roger told you. So I'm going to talk about bell inequalities when you have many different sites. I mean, I'll mostly focus on three sites, but there could be more. Except I'll be talking about them in the language of games. So let me start by describing my language, and then you know I'll tell you about the results. So we're looking at this kind of setup where you have, let's say you have three different parties. So Alice, Bob, Charlie. Each of those parties holds a certain physical system. So they have it like this here, but they're spatially separated. So they share this big state that could be entangled in between them, but they're not, there's no communication. And then there's us, referee. So we're just classical machine, and we select questions that we send over to Alice, Bob, Charlie. So these are just, you know, classical bit strings. So in language of bell inequalities, those would be settings that you put for the measurements at each site. And then Alice, upon receiving her question S, she makes whatever measurements she wants, and this measurement produces an outcome, A, that she sends back. B gets an outcome B, and C gets an outcome C, and they send it back. And then the referee is going to look at whatever, you know, the outcomes that were sent to him, and then decide to accept or reject them. So I'll be focusing on XOR games. So XOR games are ones in which the answers, A, B, C, are just single bits. So those are binary measurements that are being made at every site. And the referee only looks at the XOR. So he immediately takes the XOR of the three outcomes that are observed and checks whether this XOR is equal to some function of the questions that have been sent. So this is some public function which says, okay, what's the correct answer? What's the correct XOR for these answers? So the players in playing this game have the choice of whatever entangled state they might want to start the game in and whatever measurement they could make on their share of the system. And their goal is to maximize their winning probability in this game. So instead of looking directly at the winning probability, I look at the bias. So the bias is just however much more you can do than random. So these guys here are not even using their state. They're using a completely random strategy, just answering random bits, A, B, and C. The XOR will just be a random bit, 0 or 1, and this will be equal to the correct answer with probability half. So you can always win this thing with probability half. So I look at the bias, right, the beta star of G. So G is a description of the game, so it's basically just the function F, and also the probability distribution that we put on the questions, the way we choose these settings, STU. So this will just be, by definition, this will be the maximum over all strategies. So these strategies are just observables, AS, BT, CU. These are observables for each of the players. So AS is just AS0 minus AS1, you know, where this is the measurement. And then there's a state, the entangled state psi. So then we sum over all possible questions of the probability of asking that question, right? And then we see how well the answers correlate with F. So this you can write like this, minus 1. So this is just plus or minus 1, depending on whether we want the XOR to be 0 or 1. And here I'll put whatever correlation the quantum players achieve using these measurements in this state. Can people on that side see the psi there, sort of? You can guess there should be a psi, yeah. So, okay, does that make sense to everyone? That this is the quantity that you know, players are trying to maximize, so the higher, the better, the higher their success. So the success in the game is basically a half plus this divided by 2. So the other quantity we'll be looking at is, okay, how well can classical players do? So those who do not share any entangled state, just have some kind of local hidden variable model or shared randomness. So this I'll write as beta C for beta classical. It's going to be the same expression, except now the only thing that I allow are just classical strategies. So those are just described by, you know, functions from the question to the answer, so they're just basically bits. So I'll have bits AS, BT, CU, which are just plus or minus one, and then exactly the same expression. Where this is just a product of the three bits. So this is how well classical models or classical theorists can do. So, okay, let me tell you, so that's the setup. So let me tell you what are the questions that we're interested in related to that setup. So the main question, I guess, is how large is the first quantity with respect to the second, right? So how large can PCB, because the largest, the violation we have, the most impressive, is that, no, the most impressive quantum mechanics is, and also maybe the easier it will be to, test quantum mechanics in your lab if you have a larger gap, then it's something that's probably easier to observe. Of course, it depends how complicated that optimum state and optimum measurements are. If they're too complicated, then you can't really hope to realize them. So related second question is, suppose that we show that this potentially can be large. Well, how do we find examples that realize such large violations? So how do we find? Good examples. And one thing that makes it hard to find examples is that those quantities here, beta c, beta star, we have no idea how to compute them. So if I give you a description of the game, I give you this function f, and I ask you, okay, what's beta c, what's beta star? In general, for beta c, this is known to be an NP-hard problem. I'm not going to go much into that, so I'll just tell you. This is known to be NP-hard to approximate to within a constant. So if I want to know if this is within a factor 10 of, 0.5 or 0.8, this is NP-hard problem. This one, we don't know. It's an interesting question. I'll come back to that maybe a little bit later. So we don't know if this is hard to compute or not. It could be that there's an algorithm, but if there is, we don't know it. So at least we have no procedure to compute that value. And maybe a last interesting question, at least in the multipartite scenario, is, suppose that there's a large gap, so there's this quantum entangled state and these observables that you can use in order to do much better than any classical model, then what's that state? And can we sort of understand the different, we know that, say here, tripartite entanglement, this is something, there's many different types of entangled states and have many different properties, so can we say anything interesting about them as to, in terms of how large a violation they allow us to achieve? So, maybe let me give you just a few examples to get a feeling for what kind of games people have studied, and then I'll move on to more general results. So the first example of something that you can frame is this language. This is well known. I'll maybe go quickly over it, CHSH inequality. So this is a game where there's only two players. The questions S and T are just bits. And the function that you're trying to realize, this is just the AND function. So you want that the XOR of the answers should be the AND of the two bits. So for this game, it's known that the beta star, this is 1 by root 2. And the classical is a half. So you can just compute those. This is a simple game. So the ratio, you get a violation here, which is about a factor root 2, right? So, and this is very simple, very nice. The strategy which achieves this violation here, this just uses a single EPR pair and some very simple measurements on that single EPR pair. But here we're interested into maybe larger number of parties. So there's a sort of a natural generalization of CHSH. This is called magic square. I think came, and this was introduced, I think, in a paper by Tsuyoshi Ito and Hajime Kobayashi, Preda Sun, Yao, and Sun, is it? Sun.
Yeah. Okay.
So the way they generalize CHSH inequality is this way.
So you imagine that you have a big square, which has n columns and n rows. What the referee is going to do is he's going to pick either a row or a column at random. Say he picks this row, and then, so there's n players. He's going to send each of the little boxes here to one of the players. The players are supposed to reply one bit, and the constraints are that the XOR of the answers, so here we'll have n answers. This should be one, I think, if the referee chose the first row, and zero otherwise. Right, so basically these players are trying to achieve a parity zero for almost all rows and columns, except for the first row in which they're trying to achieve parity one. So if you think about a classical strategy for that, classical strategy would just be an assignment of bits to each of the entries of the square, which satisfies the most possible of these constraints. But that's not possible, right? Because here I'm asking every column to have zero parity. If that's the case, the overall parity must be zero. But if the overall parity is zero and all the lines here have parity zero, this should also have parity zero. So that tells you that the classical bias is, well, actually it's exactly 1 minus 1 by n. So you can win almost all the time, but not quite. And what they showed is that there's a quantum strategy. And this achieves, the bias is something like cosine pi by 2n. So basically this is something like 1 minus pi squared by 8n squared. So you have an improvement of a factor. So it depends exactly how you measure improvements. If you measure it my way, just beta star by beta, this is not very large. It's a number which is close to 1. But if you think about how close to 1 each of those is, then this is a factor n closer to 1. And again, this the quantum strategy which achieves this is pretty simple. So they use natural generalization of, I guess, EPR pair, which is this GHZ state, with 1 qubit per party. So if you want to achieve that much, you just need a GHZ state, 1 qubit per party, and the measurements you make are, you know, natural generalizations of the measurements that arise in the CHSH, when you study CHSH inequality. So they're pretty simple. Let me give you one last example. Maybe I'll just do it here. It's a nice example. So it's called Merman's game. I think it's, so it's something which is due to Merman. So here you have, let's say you have k players. So you have k questions, S1 up to SK. They're just bits. They're not all possible bits. There's a constraint that the questions always satisfy that the total parity of all the questions is zero. And then the constraint, see, the description of the game itself is not so important. I'm just giving you, you know, kind of examples of things that are studied. So the constraint is that the XOR of the answers, this should be, so because you know that it's even, you can divide by 2, and then you look at the result, again, mod 2. So you look at it mod 4, and they should satisfy this constraint. And here you have something interesting. So what's interesting is that there's a perfect quantum strategy. So you can win with certainty. And again, this uses the GHZ state, just 1 qubit per party, and even more simple measurements. So the measurements here, they're just measurements in the Pauli basis, just X or Y measurements, depending on your question. So that's very simple, and you can just check. It's going to win with probability 1. But the best classical players can do is pretty low. It's at most, I think, 2 to the 2 by k by 2, where k was the number of players. So the more players you have, the harder this game becomes for classical players, whereas for quantum players, it's just always just as simple. They can win with probability 1. So here your gap, beta star by beta c, this is something which is going to be 2 to the k by 2 minus 1. So it's something which grows as the number of player grows. The reason I'm showing you this is just to kind of try to get a feeling for what kind of behavior can arise and see that things are not completely clear. So one thing that's seems to be the case is that for these games, the optimal quantum strategy is always very simple. So it uses a, you know, a simple GHZ state and simple measurements. There's a simple reason for this is that, okay, we're trying to get games which have large violations, and the way to first thing to make sure of is that there's a good quantum strategy. So that's often how you design the game. You do something that the quantum players are good at. And once you have that, you have a large quantum value, and then you try to show that classical players are not that good, so they'll achieve something lower. In terms of the violations that you get, I guess this is the most interesting. So you can get something which increases as the number of players increases. I threw it out too late, too hard. Oh, I cannot move this. Okay, well, we have more space. Okay, so what do I want to do now? Well, it's okay, I have, okay, well, I think I have enough boards anyway, so it won't be a problem. Okay, so the plan now is that I want to review a little bit first what's known for the case where you have two players, because there it's very nice, very simple, and well understood. And then I'll talk about the three-player case, which is what's new here. And the things that I want to tell you for the three-player case, so I'll get that to that later, is various things. So one thing we can show is that if actually you use a GHZ state, then the ratio here will always be a constant if you have only three players. If you have more than k players, then the best behavior you can have is that kind of behavior here. So in terms of quantum strategies which use the GHZ state, the worst possible gap you can have is basically exemplified by Merman's game. But maybe what's more interesting is that for the case of three players, we'll show that there are states for which this gap here can be arbitrarily large, even just for three players, as you let the number of questions or the local dimension of the state that you're using increase. So I'll show you both, or at least I'll state both upper and lower bounds on how large this can be in terms of the local dimension. I think maybe the most interesting thing about what we did is that we give an example of a game. It's not quite explicit. It's a probabilistic construction, but it's fairly simple. And it achieves a ratio here which goes to infinity fast with the number of questions or the local dimension of the state that you use in the game. So I get to that a little bit later. Let me talk a little bit about what's known for the case of two players first. Is it okay? Is everyone following? Okay. Do stop me or rush me if it's. Okay. So this will be fairly short. So for the case of two-player games. Two-player XOR games. I'm doing this because it'll be useful also later. So there's one main tool which lets us analyze them, which is a result due to Tillerson. And this says two things. So the first thing that it says is that, okay, take a two-player XOR game and take strategies. So these are just these observables, AS, BT, and this entangled state psi. It's saying that you can map those to vectors. So let's call them XS, YT. Those will be real vectors in twice D squared dimensions, where D is the local dimension of psi, is the dimension of those matrices, such that if you look at the correlations that arise from these observables on the state, then those are exactly reproduced by the inner product between the vectors. So you have this. So this in itself is not too hard to achieve. I'll tell you how you do it. Simply you define XS to be, in general, this can be a complex vector. I said there are reals. There's something you can do in order to make them reals, but I don't want to get into that now. And YT you can define like this, and you can check. Imagine everything was real, then this would be true. In a complex case, you can do something too. That's simple, but the good thing about Tillerson's result is that it says that you can go backwards. So it's also telling you that if you start from vectors like this, XS, YT, I should have said that they're unit vectors, which is satisfied by those since AS and BT are observables. If you start from any set of unit vectors, XS and YT, then you can actually come up with observables, AS, BT, and a state that exactly reproduce the correlations that you get from the inner product of the vectors. I'm not going to show you how to do that, but it's also not very hard. One interesting thing is that the state that you use is the maximally entangled state. So it's telling you that for that kind of correlations, the only state that's useful for you will be maximally entangled state. So why is that useful for us? Is because it lets us rephrase the calculation of the beta star there, the quantum bias, as a different kind of maximization. So based on that characterization, you can write that this quantum bias, this will be the maximum. And now instead of observables and a state, I just have vectors. So it turns out that you can take the vectors to be of the same dimension, I think maybe 2. N will be the number of questions here. Sum over ST of variables. So the same expression as before, but now we just write here the inner product between those two vectors. And we have the constraint that the norms equals 1. So why is this nice? So there's one thing at least which is really nice about this is that here we had sort of a intractable maximization. You know, what's the dimension of the entangled state psi? I don't know. So how do I compute this maximum? I just have to go over all dimensions. It is infinite, it doesn't stop. Here, I have those vectors. A priori, they were of dimension d squared, and d was the dimension of psi, so okay, what's the difference? And here I put an n. So why did I allow myself to go from d squared, which is, you know, arbitrary, to n, which is, if the game is fixed, n is a constant, which is the number of questions on the game. Well, this is because this expression here only depends on the inner products between those vectors. How many vectors do you have? 2n vectors, right? One for every s and one for every t, if there's n s's and t's. The fact that they're of a really large dimension, this doesn't matter. If you have 2n vectors, their span is of dimension 2n. So you can just say, well, I'll just restrict myself to a space which has dimension 2n. Going to something larger than n, this will not be a helpful in any way. So now this is tractable. And it's more than tractable, so you can actually compute this maximum in polynomial time, polynomial in the number of vectors, n, using a technique called semi-definite programming. So I'm also not, it's like linear programming, but except it lets you maximize over inner products of vectors. I'm not going to explain that, but it's an interesting result because it tells you that you can compute this quantum bias beta star in polynomial time, whereas the classical you could not compute. I should say, by the way, that everything that I put in this two-player XO game section, this is can be found in a very nice paper by Cleve, Oye, Toner, and Wojcicki from 2004. Okay, so now we can compute this. That's useful. And the second thing which is nice from this using this formulation is that we're going to be able to relate the quantum and classical biases using a famous inequality in functional analysis. It's called Gorton-Deeks inequality. Actually, let me put it here. Gorton-Deeks inequality. And this actually directly gives us what we want. Gorton-Deeks inequality says that whatever those coefficients here, so these could be arbitrary, let's call them alpha, st, they're just real number. Whatever those coefficients, this maximization here will be less than a constant, which is known as Gorton-Deeks constant, times the same maximization of the same expression, but now instead of inner products between unit vectors, you have product of just unit numbers. So you go from dimension n to n to dimension 1. So you have as bt in, sorry, Russell minus 1. And this was our, you know, this whole thing there. This is what I called the classical value, right? So this tells us that for the case of two-player XOR games, the maximum ratio that you can get between the quantum beta star and the classical beta c is bounded by this constant, Gorton-Deeks constant. It's a constant we don't actually exactly know its value, so, but what we do know are nice bounds. So it's between, I'm going to be very loose because I'm not sure, but it's, let's say, between 1.8 and 1.6. And we actually already knew something on this constant based on the example that I told you about. You know, CHSH game that we saw earlier. This was a game for which beta star was 1 by root 2, and beta C was 1/2. So if we just use that game, we know that this constant here should be at least root 2, right, which is about 1.4. So it's actually a little bit larger, but not much larger. This is telling you that CHSH is, you know, up to like something small is the, you know, strongest example of how much you can violate classical correlations using quantum states, as long as you restrict yourself to these kind of XOR games, which involve binary observables and token XORs. Yeah.
So the when you say we don't know the value of growth neutrons, you mean the type value, presumably.
The exact value.
And but it, that's because I mean, because the second equation doesn't depend on n.
Right.
It means so that's in the large n limit. Is what you can achieve in the large n limit.
Right. So if, sorry, no, you're right. So the content of Grothendieck's theorem is that this constant does not depend on n. So whatever the size of the game
right.
and whatever dimension of the vectors, you'll always have a constant. So, you know, presumably you could take larger and larger n and sort of exhaustively search over all possible games and strategies and get an idea for what this constant is. So it's a computable constant, but it's just that.
Yeah, sorry. No, I guess what I'm asking, let me rephrase it. So, do we know, for instance, if you have to go to arbitrarily large n to get close to the optimal value, or is there some finite n where you can achieve the optimal value and then after that it doesn't matter?
I'm not sure if we know. So, for sure, if there is a finite n for which we can achieve it, then we don't know this n. We don't know it. So I'm not sure if we know that there does not exist a finite n.
Okay.
The only thing I know is there is a family of games or of coefficients alpha, but with n going to infinity, that is known to saturate the inequality. So that if you look only at this family, then it achieved the equality kg minus epsilon. But if you want to get epsilon close to kg, you need to go to dimensions which go pretty badly with epsilon.
And so the other thing, Grothendieck's inequality applies exactly to equations of this type, or is it more general?
No, it applies to this. The only sense in which it's more general is that you can make alpha be any complex numbers.
And then, but then the constant depends on
a little bit
alpha.
Yes. Right. So there's various things which are known. If the alphas are complex, then in all fairness, you should allow AS and BT to be complex numbers, so it depends what, I guess if they're real numbers and alphas are complexes, I think this is the constant that you have. I think there's things that I know, for instance, if you look at alpha as a matrix, and if this represents a positive matrix, then there's a better constant, which is known in that case. It's better. There's like small variations like this. But this, for sure, this is the worst for general complex alpha.
Sure, the point is that when you say that Grothendieck constant is between 1.6 and 1.8,
right.
Does that mean that there is some XOR game that can achieve better than square root of 2 with two players?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so because as long as the alpha are reals, then saying, actually, they have this form, pi and stuff, this is just a normalization condition. You just define pi to be the absolute value of alpha, f to be the sine of alpha, and you just divide by the sum of the absolute values so that the probability is sum to 1. But that's a scaling. It would be on both sides of the inequality. So any real alphas you can realize by XOR game.
I think this bound is for reals.
This number here?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
If you change everything to complex, actually the constant becomes smaller.
Right, you have a better bound, but if you also allow AS and BT on the right-hand side to be complex numbers, then it's kind of another inequality, and then you get a better bound. 1.4 maybe.
I think this is the case for everything is real.
Okay. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say for the two-player case. So let's move to three-player now.
So most of what I say extends to k players, but I'll just stick to two for simplicity. So there, not much was known for a long time, apart from the examples I told you about and, you know, other classes of examples. And so recently, a few years ago, there was a sort of a breakthrough. So this is a paper by Perez-Garcia, Wolf, Palazuelos and Villanueva, and Junger. So out of these, sorry, this is one person, but these are two persons. out of these, four of them are mathematicians. So these are mathematicians. Wolf is a physicist. So they showed, for the first time, they showed sort of, you know, general results in the same sense that this is some general result which applies to every XOR game and not to an example. So let me tell you a little bit what they showed. So the first thing they showed, I already announced, they showed that the GHZ state, so if you restrict your quantum players to be using GHZ states, then you can only have bounded violations. So you can only get bounded violations. Bounded by violation, I mean what is this ratio between how well quantum and classical does. So there's some bound here, 2 to the 3 half k. K is the number of players. And Gorton-Deeks constant shows up here too. Right? Of course, you know, for k equals 2, we should recover something which at least allows CHSH, which, or allows this. So for k equals 2, I get something a little bit bigger than what I get here. Okay, the second thing is that they showed that if the entangled state psi has local dimension, so local dimension is the, say, the smallest dimension of any of the three subsystems, so if it has local dimension d, then beta star by beta should be less than root d, so it's less than a dimension. And the most interesting thing they showed is that for every d, there is a game. So there exists some game such that there is a gap which gets larger as d gets larger, and the parameters are, oh yeah, I can't move it, but everybody can see the bottom, right? And the parameters of this game are that, so psi has dimension d on one of the players, but then on the other players, it's some kind of capital D that they have no control on. So capital D, we don't know. It's something, you know, could be very large, we don't really know. And the number of questions, this was also pretty large, so it's roughly 2 to the d squared for the first person, and then 2 to the d, capital D squared for the other players. Okay, so the nice thing about this is that you can get very large violation using only three players, and a state which has, you know, moderate dimension on at least one of the players. The non-nice thing is that, okay, you have no idea about what the dimension should be for the other two players. And this is a very non-explicit construction, so they acknowledge this in their paper. It's not only that it's probabilistic, that the game can be constructed with high probability, it's also that, so they're mathematicians, their area is operator space theory, and the way this is obtained is by, you know, lifting some maps between some spaces and doing some pretty involved mathematics. So in the end, you don't really know what the game is. You just know that it exists. This is also how these results are proved, using, you know, very heavy, very deep results in operator space theory. So our results, you know, basically they generalize those and they simplify them. So we get the same thing improved, and using no operator spaces at all, but still probabilistic construction for the third item. So regarding the first point, so that's, I guess, with my quarters over there. So the first point we can extend a little bit, so that it works not only this kind of bound, not only for GHZ states, but also a slight generalization. So if you look at a GHZ state, it's a state which is of that form. And here you have a coefficient 1 by root d. So we look at states which still have a similar form, but the coefficients could be arbitrary. So here you put any kind of coefficient which varies in any way, and we show that the same bound holds also for that case. And it turned out, you know, it's not clear, okay, how more general is this than this? I don't know, but it turned out that actually showing that this inbound holds for this kind of states, this actually solves the open question in operator space theory. So you can go sort of all the way back, show this bound for this, and then you've proved something related to operator spaces that I'm not going to get into. Okay, the second thing is that I guess we can reprove this bound here, but using simple tools, new operator spaces, and we also get a bound depending on the number of questions. So what we can show is that if the number of questions is n, then the ratio violation that you can get, this is at most also root of the number of questions. And the last thing is that we have a different construction of a game, so we show all similar, for every D, there exists a game that I can actually describe to you soon, such that the violation is the same but now the dimension is D for the first player, and D for the second player, and D for the third player, so you have a better control of what the dimensions are. And the number of questions, you also have something nicer, so you have D squared questions for each of the players. So this becomes sort of more manageable compared to what the parameters were here. And also, I think it's a very simple and natural construction, so I'll explain to you how we can get something like that. Do you have questions on what the results mean, or is it okay? So I think actually I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about that example. I was going to show you how you can achieve this bound for GHZ states because it's very simple. It's actually a sort of a generalization of what's done in the two-player case for the Maximilian Panel state. But maybe I'll get to that later in case I have time. Also, this I might tell you about if I have time or not, or I might not. But let me start by describing the example because it's simple and maybe more interesting. Okay. Okay, so let's see. So the idea is really the same approach as we told about before. You know, let's try to construct games for which we have good quantum strategies, and then let's try to make it so that the classical players don't do so well. So I'll start off with tensor. So tensor T, this is arbitrary. It's going to be, tensor is like a matrix with three dimensions. So n squared, so n is a parameter. N is a parameter, and T is anything like this. So you think about it, you know, a matrix, this is just something like this. Now, T has three different dimensions, so I'll think about it as something like this. So it's kind of an array of numbers arranged in a cube. So the thing I'm going to use, a few things about Pauli matrices. So we look at this set P of Pauli matrices, sorry, in dimension n. So I guess, let me change my notation. Let me have a big N here. Let's have n be a power of 2. And let's look at the Pauli matrices on n qubits. So this is just the usual I, x, y, z on n matrices, on n qubits. What I'll use is that these form a basis of all matrices. So let's see. Okay, let's look at T. So T, you can look at it as a cube, like I did before. So the typical entry here, this will be an entry which is, you know, it has one coordinate per face, and each face itself has two coordinates. So it'll be something that I write as T II prime. Well, actually, I should put it like this. So T I J K and, oh, sorry. So, no. So let's have it II prime, JJ prime, KK prime. So that's a typical entry of T. So there's these I, J, K, etc. They're numbers is in N, right? So this I can think of as a number between 1 and N squared, and it's the first coordinate, this is the second coordinate, this is the third coordinate. This is what happens when I think of T as this kind of box here. But I can also rearrange indices and think of T as a matrix. So I can also write, rather, that T should be indexed by triples, like this. So here I'm just reorganizing my coordinates. And I think of T as an object which now is in N cubed times N cubed. So now T is a matrix. I basically just flattened the whole thing out, you know, mapping the indices in this way, right? So I'm going to think of T in the two ways all along. If we think about it this way, we can do a little bit of Fourier analysis, which is not saying much. So I'll define the Fourier coefficient of T at, let's say, P, Q, and R. So P, Q, and R, there'll always be letter for Paulis. So these are big n-qubit Pauli matrices. And this I'll just define as the inner product of T as a matrix with the tensor product P, Q, R. So which is just the inner product. So it's the trace inner product on matrices. So to write it explicitly, this would be sum over I, J, K, I prime, J prime, K prime of T. So my matrix version of T, K prime, and then P is indexed by I and I prime. So this is I prime coefficient of my matrix T, Q J J prime, and R K K prime. I guess this is just a definition of, if you see connection of Fourier analysis, great. If you don't, then I'm just defining this. The reason I'm just defining this is because basically I'm going to use that these Paulis, they're a basis for all matrices. So these tensor products of the form PQR, they're a basis for all matrices, which simply is saying that I can expand T in that basis. So what you can verify is that whatever T I started with, this has an expansion in the Pauli basis, so all PQR in PN of T hat. So T hat of PQR is this sum, it's just a number, times this matrix, P tensored Q tensored R. I think I need a normalization here, so I should put 1 by n cubed. So this is true, whatever T I started with. And I guess because these Paulis are complexes, I might as well allow my T to be a complex tensor and worry about it being real or not later on. Does everybody, I don't know if you see this, so the reason this holds is that because if you compute the inner product with this on the left, by definition you get T hat. If you compute the inner product with this on the right, because the Pauli matrices are orthogonal, all the terms are going to go to zero, except the term T hat of PQR, where you have the inner product of this with itself. And because they're n-dimensional, you'll get n cubed. So this is my normalization here. So that's the only, this is okay. It's the only piece of math I'm going to use. So now I can actually tell you what the game is and what the strategies are. But this is okay, right? It is not okay for someone. Okay. So the game is simple. Game G, so I'm going to give it to you as a Bell inequality, and then we can make a game out of this. The game will be just so the Bell, it's called Bell functional or the Bell. What we're going to do is the questions are just going to be indexed by these Paulis. So what the referee does, he picks three Paulis completely at, well, not completely at random, sorry. He picks three Paulis, sends them over. So here, I'm writing it in the classical setting. So you have these, I think I called them A before. A, P, B, Q, C, R. That's my classical strategy. And the coefficient here, this is just this Fourier coefficient. We had a P, Q, R. So maybe I could write that this is the classical bias of my game. Will be the maximum over all AP, BQ, and CR in plus or minus 1. So by the way, I haven't told you what T was, right? But here what I'm doing is that, okay, take any matrix T that you like, and we're going to see soon what kind of properties are required on T, and do the following game. So I'm phrasing it here as an inequality rather than a game, because these coefficients are actually arbitrary complex numbers. So if you wanted to get a game out of this, you'd have to take either the real part or the imaginary part of T hat, whichever one is best for you, and then do the kind of normalization that we talked about before. But now I'm just going to stick with, sorry for switching back and forth, I'll just stick to these inequalities. So that's my game, right? Start with an arbitrary tensor T, and use the Fourier coefficients as coefficients for my game. So why is this interesting? So what we're going to see is, let's look at the, you know, when I said that the reason I was using this is because I could say that there's a good quantum strategy. And this might not be obvious so far. But what we can say is that, okay, so let's look at the quantum bias, and I'm going to say that it's larger than, so I have the same thing, PQR, T hat of PQR. Now, in general, here I could be allowed to use any observables, AS, BT, and CR. But of course, you know, the reason I use these Paulis here and index the questions by Paulis, I'm just going to fix a specific strategy, and that strategy is just the provers actually applying the corresponding Pauli as its observable. So this is a specific strategy. It uses those observables. And what is the state that the provers, that the players will use? Well, I'm not telling you, but it's the best state. What's the best state? Well, this is a matrix, and the state that you're going to use is this largest, the eigenvector of that matrix with the largest eigenvalue. So what I can write is this. I'll write here instead, you know, I would write infinity for the largest eigenvalue. Instead of that, I'll write 3-3, which means it's the norm of this map when you go, when you think of it as a matrix, and it goes from n cubed, the n cubed dimension, to the other n cubed dimension. Okay, and what is this? Well, we have it up there, right? This is just equal to n cubed times the operator norm of the matrix or the tensor T that I started with, just by construction. So is that okay? I started off with any T. From that T, I define a Bell inequality. The coefficients of this Bell inequality are just the Fourier coefficients of T and the Pauli matrices P, Q, and R. Now I just showed that given the definition of the game, there is a quantum strategy which achieves a bias, which is at least n cubed, that's just a normalization factor, times the largest eigenvalue of T. So if we want a good quantum strategy, we just need a T which has, you know, good large eigenvalue. Okay, let's go back to the classical bias now. So let's look at the classical bias. So I have it written up there. Let's just fix A, B, C to be the, you know, whatever the best strategy is, and let's use the definition of T hat. So I'll get sum over P, Q, and R. And this T hat here was this inner product here. So T, P tensor Q, tensor R, AP, BQ, CR. Okay, and this inner product here, this is the trace of the product of the two matrices, so it's linear. So I can make everything go inside, and I can write it this way. So it's just the inner product of T. And then what do I have here? So I have the sum over P of APP tensored sum over Q of BQ Q tensored sum over R of CR R. Right? Okay, so I'm almost there. One more line. Let me give names to these matrices. So let's call this matrix maybe capital A. This is just a fixed matrix which depends on the plus minus one numbers here, B and C. What do I know about A? Well, it has plus minus one coefficients in the Pauli basis, right? Let's relax things a little bit. I'll just look at the norm of A. So this norm, Frobenius norm, this is just the sum of the squares of the coefficients of A. It's just the trace of A squared. When you compute the trace of A squared, you expand everything. And because the Paulis are orthogonal, it all kind of simplifies, and you get n times the sum over p of ap squared. AP was plus minus 1, so this is just 1 all the time. Number of Paulis, this is n squared in dimension n, so I guess n cubed. Okay? So just using the fact that these APs were from a classical strategy, they're plus minus 1, I get that the norm of a squared is n cubed. So now I'll go back to this bias and say that, okay, well, this is less than, and I'm just going to allow A, B, and C, instead of having that specific form, just be any form under this normalization condition. So I'll just write the maximum over all A which have norm n cubed, B and C, you know, also have the same constraint on the norm of T, A, B, C. And now I'll just rewrite one last thing here, which is just to express this. I want to express this as a norm of T, just like before we had this 3-3 norm. So this is just with T. For now, this will be 2, 2, 2. And then there's again a normalization n to the 9/2. Okay, so what is this here? Well, I don't know if you can see this. To me, it seems clear, but I am not. So, you know, what I'm looking is, when you have a matrix, let's take a matrix, M, right? When you take the maximum over all X and Y of X transpose MY, X transpose MY, this I can rewrite as the inner product between M and X tensor Y, as long as I write my M properly and my X properly, as long as I align the dimensions correctly. Maybe a better way to write this is to write it as XY transpose. This is the same. So here I have something very similar, except that, you know, it's just instead of a matrix, it's a tensor. It has these three dimensions. So if you look back at the cube up there, this expression here, A, B, and C, you have to think about them as matrices that I'm multiplying each face of the cube with. So A is acting on the face. I'm doing multiplication there. B, say, on the top face, and C on the right face. And this is what the number that results. This is this expression here. So I'm just, you know, I'm just calling it the 2-2 norm of T. The normalization here is because when you define the norm, you'd want, you know, these to be unit vectors. So at the same time, I'd want these to be normalized matrices. But here, their norm squared was n cubed. Their norm is n to the 3/2, and I have three of them. So the correct homogenization is this. But basically, okay, so what this thing here is doesn't exactly matter. What we've done is that we've started from any arbitrary tensor T. We've defined a game. We know that the quantum bias in the game, this is at least something times the largest eigenvalue of T, just when T is seen as a matrix. And the classical value of the game, this is less than the largest, also you could call it an eigenvalue, or the largest norm of T, when instead of, in the quantum case, you were seeing it as a matrix, n cubed by n cubed. Here you really see it as a tensor, n squared by n squared by n squared, so it acts on three different components. And now we're almost done. The question is, okay, we need to find T, right? So what is a T which is going to have a large eigenvalue, but will have a small norm here? So I guess I'm not going to give you details about that, but I can still just tell you what T is. Kind of, you can think about it. What's the obvious thing? We're going to pick T using some kind of randomized way, but we do want that T as a matrix has a large eigenvalue. How do you have something which has a large eigenvalue? You just take it to be rank 1, right? So the T that I'll take will be this, T, I'll define it like this, will just be, let's say, well, sorry, I just have to define the coefficients of T, I, J, K, I prime, J prime, K prime, and this will just be the product of two things, G, I, J, K, G, I prime, J prime, K prime. What is G? G I'm taking at random. So G, I, J, K, these are IID Gaussian variables. They could actually be IID Bernoulli. So just a random sign. You can think of it in this way. It's, you get the same thing. Picking a random sign here, a random sign here. And T, this is just, you can see this as an outer product between the two vectors, right? So this is rank 1 as a matrix. As a matrix, it just, you know, these three go together, these three together, and here I have a product of two things. So it's definitely rank 1. So for a certain, you know, normalization condition with respect to T, the largest eigenvalue will be high. The question is whether this will be small. it's actually not quite true if I define t this way. So you have to modify it a little bit. The only modification you have to do is to remove the diagonal coefficients. So you have to, instead of putting this, when this is ijk is equal to I prime j prime k prime, you have to set it to zero. That's the only thing. So what we can show is that if you set t like this, and let me not even give you the numbers, it doesn't matter, but obviously largest eigenvalue is going to be large because it has rank 1. And the question is whether now when you look at t in its tensor form, does it have any kind of structure that would say that it has low rank, but now not with a bipartite decomposition of space, 3-3 that was here, but with a tripartite decomposition of space? And the answer is no. So it's not hard to see that it would be no if t was completely random. Now t has some structure, it is rank 1. But this rank 1 structure, this is with respect to a way of looking at t, which does not correspond to the way at which classical players look at this t. So you have to show that they can't take advantage of that. So this involves a little bit of high dimensional. You have to prove concentration bounds and do some kind of non-trivial arguments, but it's, you know, the hardest thing is, you know, Bernstein's inequality or some concentration result. Yeah.
About the diagonals, and how does it remain rank 1?
It doesn't. It doesn't, but the point is that if, so, oh, I should, maybe let me give you the quantum state. Maybe this is obvious or not, but the quantum state, strategy we know already, right? It's the body. Quantum state, what is it? It's this, right? So if I fix t, then the best quantum state, not the best, but the good quantum state that these players can use is just this state. So if I zero out, so this is just this vector. So if I happen to zero out the coefficients on the diagonal, I will lose a little bit, but I don't lose too much because the number of coefficients on the diagonal, this is, you know, it's little o of the total number of coefficients. So if I actually use the same state, it will still do pretty good. Even though, yeah, I lost rank 1, but I still have a very large eigenvalue and a few small eigenvalues that are created by setting this result. And stop there. Maybe I wanted to mention a few open questions that I think are, you know, interesting. One is that if I go back to our example here, the bound that we have in terms of the number of questions
compared to our example, this is not optimal. This bound suggests that you might have a better example with d questions per player here instead of d squared. We don't know how to do that. Maybe a more interesting question, though, is, okay, can you get an explicit example? So this was, I think, really much simpler than what was here, but it's still probabilistic. If someone asks me, well, can you please show me t, I can't really show them. I can tell them, well, choose it this way, and, you know, you'll get something good. We also carry out the here, because it's simple, we can carry out all the computation explicitly and see what are the constants, so we can get some idea of what's the minimal dimension of t, so what's, you know, because there's implied constants here. So what's the minimal d such that this effect starts kicking in? So as far as we can tell right now, it's still pretty large. So it's reasonable. It's like maybe, let's say 100 qubits to be really safe. So this is still way too large, right? So you want something much more concrete. So that's, I have no idea how to do that. And maybe one last thing is that the state here, so the state that's, you know, we showed that if you use a GHZ state or that kind of more general, that kind of state, you can only get bounded violations. So forget k, you should set k to 3 here. It was the number of players, you get a constant. If you use that kind of state, which is basically just a completely random state where the coefficients are chosen just as plus minus 1 independently, then you can get very large violation, this root d or something. So, but there's maybe more interesting work to be done as to understanding what property about the states makes it that they're, you know, much more useful in these tripartite setting than other states. So why is this so much more useful than GHC, or what's the appropriate measure that distinguishes that state from the GHC states? So there's many different measures for multipartite entanglement. And my last question is, can you say anything about the hardness of computing these biases? So I said this for the case of two-player games. There's actually a polynomial time algorithm to compute beta star given the description of the game. This was based on Tilson's characterization and semi-definite programming. So in the case of three or more players, we don't know. So the classical bias, this is NP-hard. It's NP-hard even to give constant factor approximations. But for the quantum bias, we have no idea. Actually, you can use our result here, even the result by Perez-Garcia, to say that if you want to know what is the best that you can achieve using only a GHZ state or this state, then this is an NP-hard problem. It's an NP-hard problem also within any constant factor. This is just a consequence of what I said, but I'm making it more explicit. But in general, you know, you don't. Why would you restrict yourself to this? Right? You just want to know what's the best you can do with any state. This we don't know if there's like the two-player case, there would be a polynomial time algorithm, or maybe it's not. I guess maybe it's not, but I have no idea. So, okay, I think I should stop here. Thanks.
So, are there any questions? Actually, I wanted to ask about the significance of XOR games. Can you say anything about non-XOR games, or maybe why XOR games are?
I don't know if, so I would say significance is in the simplicity. So you first try to understand things that are simpler. This is simpler because the observables that you need are only binary observables. Now, why would you look only at the XOR of the outcomes instead, you know, just taking something fine binary but not look at the XOR? So for the case of two players, one motivation to do that is because we can really understand it. So, you know, so binary games are also studied, games with, so this is one direction in which to take things. Basically, the only setting we understand is two players XOR. You can take it in the direction that I've taken it here by saying, you know, let's, okay, try to understand something a little bit broader by having more players, but keeping things XOR, which is the simplest possible. Or you could say, well, let me keep two players, but let me make it binary or maybe ternary and try to understand. So there's also things which are known in that setting which are interesting. So if you increase the size of the answers, here also you can get larger violations with only having two pairs. But I guess, yeah, as far as I would say, the motivation is just that, you know, you try to understand things that you can understand, hopefully.
Any questions?
Yeah.
So you're
saying
that
that here is on the archive if anyone is interested. This bound by these authors. The rest that I've been talking about here, this is work with Jörg Biet, and it's not on the archive yet. So, you know, if you have any questions, I'm here until Friday.
So,
so
let's thanks once.